I never expected my train ride home to turn into a nightmare. It was a cold evening and the train was packed with tired commuters, lost in their phones or staring blankly at the floor. I had taken this route 100 times before, just another ordinary night in the city, but this time something felt off. I first noticed him standing near the middle of the train car, a tall, rough-looking man with wild eyes and a nervous energy that made my skin crawl. His hands twitched at his sides, and his lips moved as if he were whispering to himself. At first, I thought he was just another troubled soul, someone lost in his own world. But then I saw where his attention was focused. Two young women sat nearby, speaking softly to each other. One of them wore a hijab, her dark eyes darting nervously toward the man. He was staring at her, his face twisted in something between a sneer and a smirk. Then I heard it, low, ugly murmurs. I couldn't make out the words, but I saw the way the girl shrank back, pressing closer to her friend. Her hands trembled as she gripped the strap of her bag. Something inside me tightened. The train clattered along the tracks, the fluorescent lights above flickering for a moment. The man leaned in closer to the girl, his voice still too low for me to hear, but his body language said enough. She was terrified. And then, without warning, he shoved her.
Oh!
She yelped as she hit the floor, her hand slamming against the hard surface of the train. Her friend gasped, bending down to help her. The entire train car went silent, the air thick with shock. I felt my body move before my mind even caught up.
Hey!
I shouted, stepping forward.
What the hell is wrong with you?
The man turned to me slowly, as if I had just interrupted something important. His lips curled into a lazy grin.
Mind your own business,
he muttered. My fists clenched.
You just assaulted her. Apologize!
He snorted.
Why should I? She doesn't belong here anyway.
That did it. Before I could say anything else, two other men in the train stood up beside me. One was older, in his 50s maybe, with tired eyes but a strong stance. The other was younger, in a business suit, his jaw tight with anger.
Leave him alone,
the older man said, his voice calm but firm.
You're harassing people, the younger one added. You need to stop.
The man's grin faded. His eyes flitted between the three of us, calculating. The train rocked as it sped through the tunnel, the windows reflecting our tense standoff.
Big heroes, huh?
The man muttered.
Think you can tell me what to do?
The tension was thick, ready to snap. My pulse pounded in my ears. The other passengers were frozen, some clutching their bags, others pretending not to see what was happening. Then, everything exploded. A glint of metal. Before I could react, pain ripped through my side. My breath hitched as I stumbled backward, a sharp burning sensation spreading through my stomach. He had a knife. I barely had time to process it before he turned on the older man. A quick, brutal stab to the chest. Blood bloomed on his shirt. He gasped, eyes wide, and collapsed onto a seat.
No!
The old man screamed. The younger man tried to run, but the attacker was fast. The knife slashed across his throat in one horrifying motion. He fell instantly, his body crumbling to the floor. I pressed a shaking hand to my stomach, my fingers wet with blood. My legs felt weak, the world tilting around me. The train car erupted into chaos. People screamed, scrambling to the far end of the train, some trying to pry open the doors. The two girls huddled together, sobbing, their faces pale with shock. The attacker stood there, chest rising and falling, his knife dripping red onto the floor. His eyes flicked around, wild and unfocused. He wasn't done. My vision swam, but I forced myself to move. I had to stop him. With whatever strength I had left, I lunged at him. My shoulder slammed into his side, sending him stumbling back. He growled in frustration, swinging the knife wildly, but I dodged, just barely. He wasn't expecting me to fight back. I grabbed his arm, trying to wrench the knife away, but he was strong, too strong. He shoved me hard and I hit the metal pole behind me, my ribs screaming in pain.
The train screeched as it neared the next station. The lights flickered again, and then red and blue lights flashed outside. Cops. The train door slid open, and officers stormed in, guns drawn.
Drop the weapon, now!
For a moment, the man just stood there, his chest heaving, the knife still clutched in his bloody hand. Then, like a trapped animal, he lunged toward the door. A gunshot rang out, not a fatal shot, just a warning. The man froze. The cops tackled him to the ground in seconds, wrestling the knife from his grip. Handcuffs snapped around his wrists. It was over. I don't remember much after that. My body gave up and everything blurred. I woke up in a hospital bed, the sterile white walls too bright, the steady beep of machines filling the silence. The nurse told me I had survived. Barely. The knife had missed my vital organs by inches. The other two men, they weren't so lucky. Ricky and Daniel, those were their names. Two ordinary men who had just wanted to help, who had stood up for what was right, and they had lost their lives because of it. The news covered the story for weeks. They called it a hate crime. The man, his name was Charles Barker, had a history of violence, of extremist beliefs. He had boarded the train looking for trouble, and he had found it, but so had we. I still think about that night, about the two men who never made it home, about the two girls who were just trying to exist in a world that saw them as different. I survived, and as long as I'll live, I'll make sure people remember what happened that night, because hate only wins when good people stay silent, and we didn't. On May 26, 2017, Jeremy Joseph Christian carried out a brutal attack on a Max light rail train in Portland, Oregon. Christian, known for his extremist views and history of violent behavior, began harassing two teenage girls, one wearing a hijab, shouting racist and Islamophobic slurs. Three men, Taylorson Mierden, Namkai Mesh, Ricky John Best, and Micah Fletcher, intervened to protect the girls. Without warning, Christian pulled out a knife and stabbed all three men. Taliesin and Ricky suffered fatal wounds and died at the scene, while Micah survived with serious injuries to his neck. Christian fled the train but was arrested shortly after. During his trial, Christian showed no remorse, making racist outbursts in court. In 2020, he was convicted of murder, attempted murder, and hate crimes, receiving a life sentence without parole. The attack was wildly condemned as an act of hate-fueled violence, highlighting the dangers of extremism. Being a class teacher was something I dreamt of since I was a teenager, dealing with kids, connecting with them, making them learn, and watching them grow has always been the best feeling. The smell of pencils and old paper filled my classroom, and the usual chatter of kids buzzed around me. Gabriel Fernandez sat in the second row, head down, scribbling in his notebook. He was quieter than the others, a little bit more reserved, but always polite, always eager to learn. I should have known. I should have seen it earlier. The first time I noticed something was off, it was his eyes. They weren't just tired, they were empty, like the light inside of him was fading. A dark bruise peeked out from under his shirt collar, yellow around the edges, like it had been there for days. When I asked him about it, he flinched, his small hands curling into tight fists.
"Just fell,"
he whispered. A chill ran down my spine. The way he said it sounded fake, like he'd been told to say it. The next week, Gabrielle came to school with a busted lip, the skin split and swollen, dried blood stuck in the corner of his mouth. His hands shook as he held his pencil, and when I handed him a tissue, he pulled back like he thought I was going to hit him.
"Who did this to you?"
I asked, kneeling beside him. My heart was racing, and my stomach turned.
"My mom and her boyfriend,"
he mumbled, so quiet I almost didn't hear him.
"They don't like me."
A heavy feeling settled in my chest.
"I can help you, Gabriel,"
I whispered.
"You just have to tell me everything."
His lips quivered, He glanced over his shoulder like someone was watching.
They say I'm gay,
he finally said, his voice cracking.
They don't want me.
I clenched my fists. He was just a kid, 8 years old. How could anyone? I reported it right away. Child Protective Services said they'd look into it. But the next day, Gabrielle didn't come to school. Or the day after that. When he finally came back, he looked worse. His small body was thinner. His cheeks hollow. His arms. God, his arms. Cigarette burns. Deep purple bruises. Red welts that looked angry and raw. I couldn't breathe.
What happened?
I asked, trying to keep my voice steady. His lips were dry and cracked.
They made me eat cat litter, he said. They made me eat rotten spinach from the trash.
I ran out of the classroom, holding back tears, and called CPS again.
You need to get him out of that house. Now.
I said, my voice shaking. Ma'am, we have a lot of cases.
I don't care! They're torturing him!
They said they'd follow up. I should have done more. I should have taken him and run. Gabrielle stopped talking after that. The spark in him was fading fast. Then one Monday, he came to school with two black eyes, the skin around them swollen and purple, his left eyelid barely open. His knuckles were raw like he'd been scrubbing something for hours. He moved slowly, like every step hurt. I pulled him aside, whispering,
I won't let them hurt you anymore, okay? I swear.
He looked up at me, those big brown eyes full of something that scared me. Acceptance, like he knew he wasn't going to make it. 2 weeks later, Gabriel Fernandez was dead. They found him on the floor of his mom's apartment, his little body beaten and broken. I was horrified knowing the details about what Gabrielle's own parents did to him. How could someone be so cruel to a child? Are they even humans? My legs trembled and my heart burned in pain. The thought that Gabrielle died because of his evil parents made me question everything sane. And through it all, he still loved them. In the hospital, in his last moments, he told the nurses,
Make sure my mom's okay.
I screamed when I heard. I collapsed at my desk, shaking with anger and grief. I'd begged, I'd pleaded, but the system failed him. I failed him. The trial was a mess. Izaro Aguirre, the monster who did this, sat in court with cold, dead eyes. Pearl Fernandez, Gabriel's mother, didn't cry, not once. They played the tapes of Gabriel's last moments, his cries, is begging for help. The horror he went through. I wanted to cover my ears, to forget the sounds of his pain. Aguirre got the death penalty. Pearl got life without parole, but it didn't feel like justice. Gabriel was still gone. Sometimes I'd dream about him. He's sitting in my classroom, head down, drawing pictures of happy families, families that would never hurt him. I wake up screaming because I know how his story really ended, and no punishment will ever be enough to make up for what they did to him. I heard his voice in my head, his last words to me,
Help me.
And I didn't. I kept going over that moment, wondering what I could have done differently. Could I have gone to his house? Could I have pushed harder with the authorities? Could I have protected him from the people who were supposed to love him? The guilt eats at me. A constant weight on my chest. Gabrielle's face stays with me. His eyes empty. His shaky voice. The bruises that told a story he was too scared to share. I think about the other kids in my class. The ones who laugh and play and trust the world to keep them safe. I watch them more closely now. Looking for signs. For anything wrong. But no matter how many I help, it'll never be enough. Because Gabriel is gone, and the world feels darker without him. The case of Gabriel Fernandez is one of the most tragic instances of child abuse in U.S. history. In 2013, 8-year-old Gabriel died after months of brutal torture by his mother, Pearl Fernandez, and her boyfriend, Izaro Aguirre.
in Palmdale, California. Gabrielle was beaten, starved, burned, shot with BB guns, and forced to eat cat litter. Desperate multiple reports to social services and law enforcement, authorities failed to intervene in time. On May 22, 2013, Gabrielle was found unresponsive and later died in the hospital due to his severe injuries. Aguirre was sentenced to death, while Pearl Fernandez received life without parole. The case led to widespread outrage and calls for child welfare reform. Social workers involved faced criminal charges but were later dismissed. A Netflix documentary, The Trials of Gabrielle Fernandez, shed light on the systematic failures that contributed to his death, sparking discussions on child protection laws. I can still recall the initial time I met him, Dr. Larry Nassar, a name that ought to stand for safety, healing, and trust, turned out to be a nightmare from which I can never awaken. I was only 15, a talented gymnast, my days a whirl of chalk on my hands, searing routines, and an endless quest for perfection. My aspirations were ingrained in the shine of gold medals and deafening applause. I believed in the coaches who trained me and the schools that promised to protect my future. It was a fragile thing, though I didn't realize it then. The Michigan State University Clinic towered like a cathedral of hope. I'd heard whispers of athletes revived under Nassar's treatment, torn ligaments repaired, spines corrected, careers saved. My coach, a woman with a clipboard always clutched in her hand, had nodded curtly when I groaned through a vault drill.
"Go see Larry,"
she'd instructed.
"He'll get you fixed up."
Her tone brooked no argument. The waiting room smelled of ammonia and ambition. Framed newspaper clippings adorned the walls. Olympians mid-flight, their bodies coiled like springs. A girl beside me, maybe 13, clutched a stuffed bear, her leg bouncing nervously. I wondered if her stomach churned like mine. When the nurse came and called me, I trailed after her down a clean white corridor. My leotard stuck to me, the fabric still wet from practice. His office was a shrine to himself, awards that shone like teeth. Pictures of beaming girls paused in perpetuity. He rose when I walked in, his smile disarmingly warm.
"Welcome," he said, as though welcoming a visitor. "Let's see what we can do for the pain," he said.
Then he put on gloves. The examination table was cold beneath my thighs. He hummed as he worked, a tuneless sound that filled the silence. At first, his touch was clinical, probing the knot in my lower back. But then his hands slid lower, fingers grazing the edge of my uniform. My breath hitched. He paused, tilting his head.
"Just checking for muscle tension,"
he explained, his voice smooth as oil. I nodded, teeth digging into my lip. "This is what healing feels like," I chastised myself. But his hands delved deeper. The world spun, my heartbeat in my ears. Was this normal? Was I dreaming it? He smiled softly, taking notes on a clipboard.
"You're doing great."
The compliment was a yoke. I gazed at the ceiling, tallying water spots until he finally moved away.
"We'll have to have weekly sessions," he said, patting my knee, "to avoid further damage."
The second appointment was worse. No gloves today, no clipboard. His hands bare and greasy with lotion, pressed down on me before I could breathe.
"Relax," he whispered. "This will ease your hip alignment."
My mother sat 6 feet away, turning the pages of a People magazine. A towel draped over Nassar's wrist hid her view. I stared at a poster of the Olympic rings on the wall, their colors running together as tears pricked. A man who had sworn an oath to heal was breaking me apart from the inside out. Then I staggered to the parking lot, my legs shaking. My mother squeezed my shoulder and asked whether I was feeling better or not. I smiled weakly.
"Yeah, much."
The shame fermented in silence.
During practice, I winced when coaches made me change my stance. At night, I scrubbed my skin raw under the shower, the water burning. I said nothing to anyone, because who was I to question a man so respected, so admired? But the cracks widened. In the locker room, a teammate grumbled about
strange treatments.
We didn't look at each other. Our shame was a mutual secret. Years later, I discovered she'd been seeing him too, her file as thick as mine. By 2016, the rumors became a roar, an investigative piece, a police report, a hashtag. When I called the prosecutor's office, my hands shook so hard that I misdialed twice. The woman on the phone was patient.
"Take your time,"
she said, but time was already lost to us. The backlash was swift. Attention seeker, they called me online. Troublemaker, sneered a former coach. My family's mailbox brimmed with letters accusing me of lying. Yet with each survivor who came forward, her voice trembling over Zoom calls, her story mirroring mine, the weight lessened. Voices that had been silenced for decades finally screamed. In court, we were a mosaic of grit, power-dressing former Olympians, adolescents with orthodontia, and mothers holding pictures of daughters who took their own lives. When I stood up, the air was charged with all the breath collectively held. Nasser looked down at his handcuffed hands, but I addressed the judge, the cameras, the girl that I was. Judge Aquilina's eyes never left his. Sentence upon sentence stacked up. 40 years, 60, 175. The room breathed out.
"I just signed your death warrant,"
she said, and for the first time, I felt the shackles ease. We met in the courthouse lobby afterward, embracing like survivors of a wreck. A reporter asked if we had forgiven him. I shook my head. Forgiveness wasn't the issue. This was about rewriting the ending. Now, when I train young gymnasts, I observe the flinch at the approach of a stranger, the pause before the high five. We practiced protocols, no treatments in the absence of a guardian, and no secrets from parents. They roll their eyes, but I do not relent. Nasser's sentence is a life. Ours is a lifetime. The nightmares persist. His breath hot in my ear, the creak of the exam table, but they're softer now. At rallies, we pass the microphone like a baton, each voice a torch. The truth is terrifying. It's also our armor. We were girls who wanted to fly, but he clipped our wings. We were champions, but he made us feel powerless. No more. Today, we tell our stories. Today we are heard, and today we ensure that no other girl ever has to whisper in the darkness, wondering whether she will ever be believed. The world now knows the truth, and the truth is horrifying. The Larry Nasser case is one of the most notorious abuse scandals in sports history. Nasser, a former USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University doctor, was exposed for abusing hundreds of young athletes under the guise of medical treatment. His crimes spanned decades, with many victims being elite gymnasts, including Olympic champions like Simone Biles, Ali Reisman, and Michaela Maroney. In 2016, survivors came forward, leading to an investigation that uncovered Nasser's long history of abuse and institutional cover-ups. In 2017 and 18, he was convicted on multiple charges, receiving a prison sentence of up to 175 years. During his sentencing, over 150 survivors delivered powerful victim impact statements, exposing systemic failures that allowed his crimes to continue. The case led to widespread reforms in USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University, as well as a national reckoning on protecting athletes from abuse.